Welcome to Voices,
a podcast from the Institute for Human Rights and Business.
Here, we're seeking to elevate the range of perspectives
on the role of business in the world
and in people's everyday lives.
Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi, Institute of Human Rights and Business. And I'm speaking today with Mary Lawlor. Mary Lawlor has recently been appointed as the special rapporteur within the UN system, which is one of the special procedures at the UN for human rights defenders, basically to look at the situation of human rights defenders. She comes with a very distinguished line of work in this area, one of the founders, and she started up Frontline Defenders, which is a human rights organization which has done enormous amount of work for defending human rights defenders in very difficult situation. And much before that, Mary, you and I were colleagues at Amnesty. That is our past. So yes. Lovely to talk to you today.
Thank you, Celine. Lovely to be talking to you too.
I think my first question is a straightforward one, that as you begin your term, what do you see are the main challenges today?
Well, as you know, there are a lot of human rights challenges now regarding human rights defenders. The areas that I'm going to prioritise are, first of all, rural and marginalised human rights defenders, people who aren't connected to the UN or who are isolated. And these can be people, women human rights defenders, LGBTI human rights defenders who are children, and human rights defenders with disabilities, and those working on the rights of migrants, and those, as I said, in very remote areas. And I would hope that, for example, when I go and hopefully in the coming years meet with some of these defenders, that I can meet with them in their place of work rather than have all the meetings in the capital cities. Another area is long-term prisoners, human rights defenders who have been given very long terms up to life imprisonment and who are stuck there. And the reason for this is because I found through my work that, you know, there's always a flurry of activity when somebody is arrested and given a long sentence. And a lot of NGOs get involved. You have governments taking action. And then as the years go by, they fail from the sight and nobody pays any attention from them because it's so difficult to sustain action on somebody who is spending year after year after year after year in prison. So it gets reduced to maybe, you know, on the birthday or on an appeal, for the trial appeal or something like that. So to be honest, I don't know how we're going to do this, but I really want to concentrate on people like Abdulhadi Al-Khwaja in Bahrain or Azimjan Askarov, who has a life sentence in Kyrgyzstan and his very last appeal following the intervention of the Human Rights Committee to the Supreme Court failed last week. Then there are three women in Iran, for example. One of them, Nazrin Sotoudeh, has a sentence that if she's doing 12 years, but if she added up all the years for all the charges that they have brought against her, it would be 38 years. And then there's another young woman who's just 30 and she's serving a 10-year sentence. You know, so it's an area that I think is a difficult area because nobody knows what to do, but I'm hoping that over time we'll come up with some more ideas. And then, of course, there's the shocking incidents of human rights defenders who are killed and the online smearing. 85%, for example, of the human rights defenders who were killed, who were documented by Frontline Defenders, last year had previously been threatened, either individually or as part of a community. And these online smears and threats, they set human rights defenders up for attack and they lead then to an increase in hostility towards them, intimidation, physical attack, and sometimes then killing. And of the over 300 killings of human rights defenders last year, 13% of them were women and 40% of those killed worked on land, indigenous peoples and environmental rights. It's an area that I think is really important, killings, because again, you know, there is a view taken sometimes that somebody is killed and sure, there's nothing you can do for them now anyway, and you should concentrate on the people who are still alive. But I think we need to have a red line that no one should be killed. Peaceful human rights work. So they're the kind of things that we're talking about. Reprisals, of course, against offenders who are cooperating with the UN or that kind of thing. Everybody talks about how important follow-up is, but it's very difficult to have a system where there is systematic follow-up on cases.
No, absolutely. But we also are at a very peculiar transition point in history, in the sense that, you know, we have taken for granted the international architecture of human rights and so on. And war on terror, of course, was one major setback in terms of rolling back of freedoms. And Now we are seeing that with the pandemic. I mean, pandemic, of course, is a humanitarian crisis. We have tens of thousands of people have died who should have been alive, and actually substantially because of government failures. I mean, but at the same time, it is casting a pall of gloom over civil society mobilization.
Yeah.
I mean, as we are speaking today, we know that in Hong Kong, China is about to introduce new laws which are going to make it even harder for any human rights work to go on. And, you know, we have had similar laws in Hungary, similar laws, or at least practices in India that has been going on, which makes it harder for people to meet each other. This tracing technology, you know, that everybody will have it on their phone, is meant to track down people who might be carrying the virus. But it also means if a human rights defender meets another human rights defender, the state can find out if it wants to. So the purpose is being misused there. So what in your view can be done? I know it's a humongous challenge, especially when the governments that traditionally tend to speak up for human rights are themselves in a retreat.
Yeah, it's a very difficult issue. And I know it's one that the rapporteurs in at the UN have all been working on. And I know that there are, I think, 12 rapporteurs that are going to be doing their reports on the impact of COVID on whatever their mandate is. But when it comes to human rights defenders, as you rightly point out, you know, there's so many laws. On the UN website, on the COVID page, special procedures, you can see the International Centre for Nonprofit Law is cooperating with the mandate holder. And 84 countries have now introduced emergency declarations. 31 countries have put in measures that affect freedom of expression. 27, privacy, and 111, freedom of association and assembly. And yes, of course, for the common good, measures have to be put in place to protect the life and health of people. But the real problem is that, as you said, governments are using the pretext of COVID to drive measures that they probably wouldn't get away with in normal times. So, for example, in Russia, like, they're just about to install the largest camera system with the facial recognition that has ever been put in place. In Israel, they started to work with the NSO agency, which is, as you know, notorious for supplying malware to governments to gather information. Then you have the awful stuff like where you have these autocratic people like your man Duterte in the Philippines, who, when some people who were living in informal settlements protested that they hadn't got any food in the 2 weeks since the lockdown, he basically gave an order to the military and the police that they should shoot dead anyone who violated curfew. And, for example, we just did a communication today on a woman human rights defender in Nairobi. Her name is Ruth Mumbi. And Ruth had documented the eviction of very poor people from their houses and literally with nothing. And she had posted on social media. She had also looked for donations of food for these people because they had no means of survival. And she got a death threat and the police wouldn't investigate it. And then they went to her mother at midnight, whoever these people were. They said they were police and the mother told them to come back the next day. But this is how things are being turned on their head, as you say. But I think the only answer is that we do have to push for a rights-based approach that's based on non-discrimination and participation and accountability. And to understand that there are so many rights that are involved, like health and life and housing, poverty, freedom of expression and association. And then, you know, other things like domestic violence, where people are more vulnerable because of the lockdown, racism and discrimination and the rights of older person. And also, we're doing everything online nowadays, and nobody thinks twice about it. But the information that could be collected by all this online activity is horrendous. So I think it is really important that the response has to be aligned with universal human rights values, and also the interdependence and universality and interconnectedness of all rights. Because I think it's the only way that you can come back against COVID.
Absolutely. I mean, there are these older viruses in the system which are even more virulent and persistent, because we can probably find some kind of a vaccine to deal with COVID in a few years' time. But who knows about these? These will remain with us. Now, which brings me to an older story, and which, of course, you're very familiar with. And since we are the Institute of Human Rights and Business, is that in 2015 was the 20th anniversary of the execution of the Ogoni 9. And at that time, we at the Institute for Human Rights and Business had published a report with frontline defenders, in fact, and civil rights defenders, which outlined the landmark cases and provided some recommendations of what can be done, such as, you know, not being attending trials and not having slap cases and not filing criminal defamation suits and all that. Since then, of course, the International Service for Human Rights has published guidance, and Michelle Foss, your predecessor, has also made some communications in that regard. UN Working Group is also looking at the issue. So the idea of business and human rights defenders having some common interests doesn't seem as outrageous as it appeared. So what are the two or three, I mean, it doesn't have to be two or three, it could be just one or it could be five, you would like businesses to do to make the world safer place for human rights defenders?
Well, you know, I don't think it's rocket science. I think, first of all, business have to get free informed consent from the communities that are affected by their operations. You know, there has to be participation. They can't just come in and decide what they want to do without taking the situation of the communities that they are affecting into consideration and to get their consent. And, you know, they can't be doing stuff like, I recall being in a silver mine in Guatemala, where we had to drive for about 8 hours to get to this very isolated mine. And it was muddy and wet and dark, and the people were all still waiting for us when we arrived in this tin roof little hall and was freezing. And one of the things that struck me was how isolated they were. Mm-hmm. And they were indigenous people. And the environmental impact statement the business had done had been lodged in Guatemala City, which was hundreds of miles away from them. They never left their area. And it was in a language that they didn't understand. So you have to get around all that kind of stuff in the initial stages, you know.
That in the Niger Delta, once I was there, and in Yenagoa, and the environmental impact assessment statement was, of course, in Abuja and Lagos. Yenagoa is like, you know, light years away, not just a few hours away.
Yeah. So that's really important. I also think that, in my view, companies will not do proper human rights due diligence unless it's mandatory. So I think there has to be a mandatory human rights due diligence across all a company's activities, and there has to be a proper policy on protecting human rights defenders put in place, explaining why they're doing it, how they're doing it, and the access to remedies. Something like Adidas has put in human rights defenders protection policy. So I really think mandatory human rights due diligence is the most important way to go after the free, prior and informed consent, while this process is on, while it's being developed, that states will put in place the need for companies to adopt mandatory human rights due diligence. And then the other thing I'd say is investors. We saw in Honduras with Berta Cáceres, eventually after the outcry and the investigative committee that had been set up to look into the killing of Berta, eventually, once it was proven that it had been ordered by the company, that the investors, FinFund and the Dutch investor, they pulled out. So I think that there has to be more truck when it comes to investors. They can't be investing in bad behavior. They really have to do a risk assessment of the country that they're investing in and the actual project they're investing in, and to make sure that there is an enabling environment for human rights defenders there.
Now, and my final question kind of combines the last two things we spoke about, which is that given that human rights defenders are increasingly being characterized by governments as anti-national or, you know, not patriotic, and the state-centric nature within the UN itself, which doesn't make it easy to negotiate and deal with governments which are part of the system and in a sense part of the problem, what would you like companies to do to make the essential work of human rights defenders remain unharmed? Do you see possibilities of alliances? Do you see them coming together with a common program such as level playing field of the rule of law and, you know, fair trials? I'm just thinking aloud. Are these options possible?
I suppose the first thing, they have to recognize the legitimate work of human rights defenders, and they have to put in place a visibility of human rights defenders and of their work as a group that contribute to civil and just society and must be protected. And in fact, it's in all their interests to protect these people, because it creates a more sustainable society, and oftentimes it's even less expensive than if you have to deal with negative impacts. The UN is, as you know, there's a draft treaty at the moment being negotiated, and I do think that process needs to become legally binding over time. A lot of these things, they don't you don't have immediate positive impacts. And for example, when the International Criminal Court was set up, and I know it's mired in a lot of different difficulties, but nobody ever expected that the people who were still alive, who'd been heads of state like Radovan Karadzic, and yesterday there was the arrest of another person who'd been involved in the Rwandan genocide. So it is true that over time, you know, norms and standards do become known. And and I think with companies, it's the same as go states. You just have to keep plugging away at them. And try and get them to behave in a more ethical manner. And the state has to step up and take its responsibility under the UN guiding principles properly as well. I mean, I do think things like the Investor Alliance for Human Rights are very good examples of where investors are coming together, common platform of making sure that human rights is where they invest, human rights are respected and protected. So I think those things, as you say, are good. But I mean, the whole anti-national stuff about human rights defenders is going to go on, sadly, I think. And you need to come at it every way, as far as I can make out.
Yes, and it also shows that you have a very full agenda. So we wish you all the best, and we are there to cheer you, encourage you, support you, and walk with you. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you very much, Celine.